Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Candela Marini, your host, and today we're talking to Ana Beatriz Ribeiro about her book, Modernization Dreams, Lusotropical Promises, A Global Studies Perspective on Brazil-Mozambique Development Discourse. It was published by Brill Press this very year, 2020. So welcome, Ana Ribeiro, and thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
So this book is based on your PhD thesis, but also on your own life experiences. So I think it would be very nice if you could give us an idea of the person and the experiences behind this book, telling us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in global studies and particularly in development discourses.
Well, I grew up as part of the upper middle class in Brazil, and I always felt like something was off, but I couldn't really realize the extent of racism in the country until I moved abroad. I moved to the United States when I was 13 years old, and then started having discussions in school, and then later on in college at Florida International University about racism in Brazil, as seen also from the perspective of scholars who had been there. And then I started thinking about the way that we were indoctrinated to believe that there was no racism in Brazil, that it was a multicultural society that was open to all sorts of different races and cultures and immigrants, because it is a country of immigrants from all over the place. But at the same time that Brazil has prided itself in that, politically and also ostensibly in society, there was always an undercurrent. There are always sort of inappropriate jokes being made that people would just laugh off. There's basically this psychological segregation from especially Black people, and the fact that they have very little social mobility in Brazil. But at the same time, we were told growing up there that they were, you know, part of the family. If they worked as housekeepers, then they were part of our family. And but it took me a while to interrogate these things. I think the outside lenses helped me a lot with that, to see my country from different perspectives and taking some distance from it. And then as I progressed in my studies, when I moved to Europe 10 years ago, I started looking into relations between Brazil and Africa at the state level. And I became interested in that when I interned at the World Health Organization in 2011 as part of the Erasmus Mundus Global Studies program, while I was doing this program. And I actually started assembling blue trunk libraries. These are mobile health libraries that are sent to African countries of Portuguese language. So I was doing that in my internship. And I was told that the biggest donor of books was Brazil and the biggest recipient was Mozambique. But then I realized that I Well, my colleagues knew a lot about Brazil. I knew very little about Mozambique. We had not been taught about African countries properly in school in Brazil. And so I decided to visit Mozambique for my master thesis, for writing my master thesis. And I stayed with a fellow intern from Mozambique. And she basically took me by the hand and showed me around. And then I started meeting people and asking them about their views on Brazilian culture. And through those connections there, I started meeting, you know, people in government, Brazilian diplomats, people involved in Brazilian corporations in Mozambique. And I started investigating their cooperation and also how people from Mozambique saw people from Brazil and how people from Brazil saw people from Mozambique, their impressions of each other. And then slowly I started getting into the discourse that I investigate in my book.
Yeah, you tell this anecdote of the moment where you realized that Brazil was an important donor from Mozambique, and this kind of awakening moment, right, where you suddenly saw the two countries in a very different perspective from that of that you had seen previously, particularly from an European and also North American perspective while studying there, if I got you right from what you say in the book. Because I got the feeling that you propose a critique or at least a problem in saying that a lot of the people that study global studies, but also development discourses, and many researchers, even those belonging to the global South, study and are very much trained in research centers in the global North, and that this has an effect on the way they understand development projects and the modernization paradigm in general. Would you agree? Or
well, definitely to a certain extent, because where they're studying, there's a certain tradition, there's a certain theoretical background and way of thinking and disciplinary background. But in my case, interestingly enough, it took me moving to the global North to be more critical towards it, you know, because growing up in Brazil, we very much wanted to be as white as possible. And development meant being white and being a certain, and having, wearing certain name brands, you know, driving certain cars, you know. And I started to interrogate this, and I actually saw this also in Mozambique, and I saw this, we have this in common in many parts of the quote unquote developing world, you know. So studying in the North, and also like in an institution like Leipzig University that is critical towards that approach, helped me see it in a different way. So it really, it also depends on your institution's approach to African studies. So I think they are self-critical here towards a Eurocentric model, you know, and they deconstruct these things more.
Since you mentioned this a few times already, would you like to explain a little bit more this Brazilian myth of racial democracy and the attempts throughout the 19th and 20th century, particularly 19th century, of whitening the society, or at least the ideal of whitening the society?
Yeah, so for a while, after slavery, we had in Brazil this initiative to bring a lot of labor immigrants from Europe to whiten the population. And actually, this didn't start with him, but Gilberto Freire, who I talk a lot about in the book, he was one of the first authors to recognize some sort of influence of African people in Brazilian society, and talk about a mixing of influences between them and the Portuguese. And he wasn't the first to recognize the Portuguese influence in Brazilian society, of course, but he was the first to recognize this mingling of influences. But at the same time, he became friends with the Salazar dictatorship in Portugal, and he started being a defender of colonialism. So you have, on one hand, you know, a recognition of Black people's influence, and on the other hand, a very strong colonial agenda, because Portugal was trying to hang on to its Portuguese colonies. Even into the 1970s, you know, there was a colonial war, whereas other colonial powers had given up their colonies before. So he became a sort of an official diplomat for both Portuguese and Brazilian political strategies or political agendas. And part of this was to say that in countries like Portugal and Brazil, there was no racial intolerance, and that racism in Portuguese colonies was a myth. And he would say that they're not even colonies, they were overseas provinces of Portugal. So this both served to defend the Portuguese colonial cause and to build up nationalism in Brazil, to unite people around a certain discourse, to say, you know, Brazil is a tolerant country and it was molded by the Portuguese, it was molded by the Africans, and we have this sort of ideal race that has come out of it, which is, you know, the mixed race in Brazil. But he always put the Portuguese above the Africans to a certain extent. He said that the main influence was the Portuguese influence in Brazilian society, because they were the transatlantic miscegenators of the world. So, and he was also marketing Brazil as the ideal society to be copied in African countries.
Was there a place for the indigenous communities in the Brazilian model?
Well, he talked a little bit about the indigenous communities, but his focus was more on Africa. I think also because Brazil had an interest in a market in African countries. So he moved this theory from Brazilian domestic society to abroad, to including these other countries, in order to, as I said before, advance both the Portuguese and the Brazilian agendas. And he portrayed Brazil as the heir of Portuguese influence in Africa. So there was very much a political strategic component to his books, especially after the 1950s.
Right. I want to talk more about Freire, but before, I would like to take a step back, and maybe you can give us an idea of or an overview of the history of the idea of development itself and how it is tied to colonial discourses such as the civilizing missions and things like that, so that then we can better understand what Freire was doing in the mid-20th century.
So the idea of development as we know it today came to the fore under President Truman of the United States. He gave his inaugural address where he talked about basically countries that were receiving American aid through the Marshall Plan. They were supposed to spread quote-unquote civilization and to spread liberal capitalist ideals to other countries as a thank you for this. So they were supposed to make these countries into their image through development aid. And then at the time, still, there are a lot of colonies in Africa, including, of course, the countries of official Portuguese language in Africa. And the international organizations jumped on board, and they also helped colonial powers by giving money, you know, for them to implement development project in their colonies. And this happened with Portugal. So you can see, I found archival documents of aid from the World Health Organization, for example. And the idea of technical cooperation, which Brazil advertises as its main sort of development aid, as something, in a sense, innovative, actually already in the 50s was being implemented by the United Nations, and the discourse hasn't changed that much. So a lot of these discourses around development, about around modernization, rapid industrialization with external help, and making basically a homogeneous capitalist society across the world, that hasn't changed that much, even though we have had other theories pop up, such as Dependencia, that claim to challenge this idea. Like, the core of modernization, in my view, has not been challenged.
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about the different terminology? Because it's true, there are a lot of ways of defining the inequalities and differences in power and wealth in the world, right? You have North and South, West and East, First and Third World, and Center and Periphery, and now mostly Global North and Global South. What's the difference between all these terms, and has anything actually changed?
I think the terminology of Third World is not so much used anymore, because over the past few decades, you have had the emerging powers come into play. And another change has been the end of the Cold War. So you don't have the second, quote unquote, second world anymore. So that has become obsolete. But definitely the designations of North and South, South, East and West are still in use. And I would define the Global North and Global South in terms of like a binary pair with a symbiotic relationship, representing development and underdevelopment and other, terms that are around it. So Global North and Global South would be more economic, it's economic factors that differ them. And I see East and West more in terms of ideology, what differentiates them based in ideology. So the West in Western discourse is portrayed as the more advanced one, as the more progressive one, as the more industrialized scientific base, and the East as more backwards, as more traditional, and so on and so forth. And to the North and South, as to the divisions between North and South, you also have that, but it's more in terms of economic development, because ideological and economic, quote-unquote, development go in hand in hand. So they use that terminology when they're talking about parts of the world in different ways or for different questions.
Mm-hmm. And you were mentioning before the dependency theory and the critique and how at its core it actually didn't change that much. Could you expand on that?
Well, I can. There are different strands of dependency theory, but I think the one that we know the most in Latin America, because it's the most successful one, and also it came from Latin America, it's Fernando Henrique Cardoso and Faletos' take on dependency theory. And it was also adopted, beyond Latin America in African countries such as Mozambique. And Brazil and Mozambique also could connect in that way. And basically, it means working within the system with the development parameters in place in order to have a bigger piece of the capitalist pie. So it does not try to, bring down the theory of modernization or promote an alternative. It gives, ways in which Brazil could become a more industrialized country, a more powerful country. So it's not at the bottom of the totem pole. And Fernando Henrique Cardoso gave an interview on this some years ago, saying that, I don't like capitalism, but it's unavoidable. So we must work within it. So it never quite challenged what it meant to be developed. It just said, countries should do something to try to get out of their disadvantage. And this is what you can do within the system, instead of like overturning it.
So, and you were mentioning before that Gilberto Freire was a key figure in redefining Brazil's place as a global actor. So we could say he provides like the foundation for the key ideas justifying Brazil's presence in Africa.
Yes.
Could you tell us who he was, why he was so influential, and then maybe more about his ideas of particularly the term lusotropicalism.
Gilberto Freire was, I believe he was born in 1900, so right after the abolition of slavery in Brazil. And his grandmother was actually a plantation owner. And so his particular social class was going through a loss of power and of status in society, so they needed to adapt somehow, right? So Gilberto Freire, he went to study abroad. He studied in the United States. And spent some time in Europe as well. And interestingly, while he was abroad, he started looking at Brazil in a different way. You know, this often happens, I think. And then in 1933, after having spent some time abroad, he wrote The Masters and the Slaves, Casa Grande e Senzala, which is probably his best-known book. And it was innovative, as I said before, because it recognized some of the contributions of Africans to Brazilian society, but always in a subaltern position. And he portrayed slavery almost as a benign institution. And he would say, you know, that the slaves were, you know, part of the family, you know. And this is very similar to what people would say about housekeepers who were getting paid, you know, very little, and lived in the household, even as I was growing up. You know, almost everyone that I knew, you know, in the middle class upwards had a housekeeper, you know. And they're part of the family, but they're always, you know, sitting in the kitchen, you know, having lunch and not sitting at the table. But it's really amazing how the ideas from this book and the ideas that he was spreading and his supporters and people who followed this theory we're spreading, how they have lasted for so long in Brazilian society, right? So with Casa Grande e Senzala, he focused on the domestic level. And then as he became more political, as time wore on, and he had an allegiance with the Salazar dictatorship in Portugal, and with the Brazilian government, also Getúlio Vargas in 1950s, he went on a tour of the Portuguese colonies in Africa, and then he wrote a book called Ilusio Tropico. He also wrote other books about this, but this one was perhaps the most interesting and the one I focus the most in my book, because he wrote this during special celebrations in Portugal of colonialism. So this was basically a propaganda book, right? But it became so influential in terms of the way in which diplomats communicated with their contacts in Africa. Even during the Brazilian dictatorship, there was a lot of activity of diplomats going to Africa trying to win over markets there on the heels of the end of colonialism. And an American scholar called Jerry Davila, he wrote a book called Hotel Tropical, where he talks about this lusotropical-inspired action in Africa in the 60s and 70s, and how Brazilians would go there and say, yeah, no, we're just like you guys. We're like, there's no prejudice in our country, and we can make great business deals together. And then Brazil started selling its equipment, saying that it was more appropriate for the African environment because Brazil was a tropical country like the African country. So they had similar environments, and they were that Brazil was in a position as a mediator between Africa and Western countries, African countries and Western countries, because it had been colonized by the Portuguese, but also had African influences. So this very much became a political discourse also tied to Brazil's position in between, because Brazil was trying to be a cordial player in international relations and pragmatic player, and try to find markets everywhere that it could. So it would say whatever was appropriate for that occasion. It was very flexible in its diplomacy. And in Africa, that's what it was saying. But in Brazil, this was not reflected in Brazilian society and in the treatment of Black people in Brazilian society. And most people in Brazil, I would say that they still know very little about these fellow former Portuguese colonies in Africa, or yeah, if they care at all, you know, I'm not sure. So I certainly didn't know about them until I moved abroad. So I had heard of them, but, you know, my knowledge was folkloric at best. So.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And another thing that was pretty amazing when I was reading it is that in this discourse, they use slavery actually as another factor to justify Brazil's presence in Africa, right? You say that Brazil's cooperation projects are sold as a way to retribute African countries for all the enslaved peoples that were taken to Brazil, and how as a sort of like repaying a debt.
Yeah, repaying using development to repay a debt. Yeah, for Africans being forcefully taken to Brazil and helping build so much of Brazilian society. But there's another part of this discourse is that slavery created the first connections, the first economic connections between Brazil and Africa, like directly, like the slave trade. And there are a lot of returnees, when they were freed, they went back to Africa. So you do have, yeah, descendants of Brazilian slaves living in Africa. And during the 60s, there was a big promotional campaign there where, you know, returnees who had come to occupy important political positions participated and said, yes, we're all kindred spirits. And so that's why we should have deals together, you know.
But then you also mentioned that, for instance, most of the people that were taken from Africa were from the West Coast, the ones that arrived to Brazil, and not from regions like from what today is Mozambique, right?
Yeah, most of them came from West Africa. Some did come from Mozambique, but the majority, like I would say that the closest connections between Brazil and Africa in terms of the former Portuguese colonies are with Angola. There's a stronger relationship with Angola than with Mozambique in terms of economic, in terms of trade, and in terms of culture, probably as well. Even though, I mean, Brazilian soap operas, I mean, in contemporary times, you know, this does influence people. You know, the Brazilian soap opera is a Brazilian church that's also present in Mozambique. The evangelical church, Igreja Universal, is very much present there. So that all also brings, you know, a lot of Brazilian elements into popular culture there.
And did this presence expand together with the development projects, or was it something that you think was independent of that?
I think it all started happening around the, I mean, development came before, development deals came before the church, for sure. But on the heels of Brazilian communities being formed there, you have other Brazilians coming, you know, because Igreja Universal, it's probably easier for them to make it there if there are already some Brazilians in the community, you know, some people who already follow the church, to also help indoctrinate others, you know. But development aid itself between Brazil and Mozambique informally started already, I would say, in the 1970s. And during and after the war, actually members from the Brazilian Communist Party were going to Mozambique to work in the government to help with rebuilding the country. And then in 1981, there was an official cooperation deal. Even during the Brazilian dictatorship, even though they were supposed to be diametrically opposed in their ideology. So I would say, you know, the first, in contemporary times, it was a diplomatic action. And then, you know, other things followed after that. But definitely, these things are connected because, you know, of the nature of the service industry, you know, one thing attracts the other.
And you provide a very detailed account of how Freire's ideas were adopted and adapted by state officials in Brazil. And you go through the different governments of Cubiche, Quadros, Goulart. Could you tell us a little bit about that? And then, as you were mentioning, how that changed with the end of the dictatorship in Brazil?
Sure. Until Jânio Quadros' election in 1960, the Brazilian presidents and other high-level politicians were focusing on the part of Freire's theory that talked about how Portugal and Brazil were close. So they would talk about Brazil and Portugal as agents and the colonies in Africa as passive recipients of their advances. So during the Kubitschek presidency, there was even a sort of a megalomania, you know, saying that maybe, you know, Brazil can join Portugal in, you know, colonial efforts in these countries and partake in the loot, basically. And then, but already during Kubitschek, there were some currents in Brazil that wanted, you know, to give more agency to African countries in the discourse and saw, you know, African countries more as that it could be a better deal for Brazil to look at them by taking Portugal more out of the equation and taking the lead. Also because Portugal was declining as a colonial power at the time. So when the election of Quadros in 1960 marked the advent of the independent foreign policy in Brazil, where this particular camp that wanted to give more importance to African countries came to power, right? And this was also as a response to the United States not giving as much importance to Brazil as a partner as Brazil thought that it deserved, because it had, you know, helped the United States during World War II, and, you know, it considered itself almost as a, when it was convenient, it considered itself a Western country. So it was looking to diversify markets. And in the 1960s, you know, this big effort started to, you know, send more diplomats to Africa, to send more economic expeditions to Africa. And this continued through the João Goulart presidency until 1964, until there was until his government was overthrown by the military. And then for the first few years, while the war was going on, the colonial wars that started in 1961, while they were going on, Brazil went back to a more of a stance of supporting Portugal and not in detriment of these countries' independence. But then as it was getting closer to independence, like the you know, the mid-70s, beginning to mid-70s, then Brazil started, you know, putting in more efforts again in Africa. And then it became the first country to recognize independence of certain countries, independence of Angola, you know, they like to say that. But at the same time, it was waffling in the United Nations, so trying to please Portugal at the same time, and please the nascent regimes in Africa to be in that in-between position and gain new markets. And then Petrobras came to Angola in the 1970s, and then, you know, the military dictatorship had no problem dealing with these countries, even though economically, even though, you know, they had socialist regimes. So I would say that the pragmatism has remained in Brazilian politics. It has been a running thread in Brazilian politics, no matter pretty much who's in power, if they're, you know, right wing or left wing. Or. And then there was a period of great activity. And then in the 90s, it died down a bit where, you know, when the structural adjustments happened and economic crises and liberalization, and then it picked back up with Lula. And many scholars credit Lula with starting a rapprochement with Africa, but actually, you know, there had been periods before him where this happened, and he was reviving a certain kind of discourse that had been repressed during the dictatorship to a certain extent.
Right. Then, but with Lula, you do see a more kind of aggressive propaganda regarding this cooperation and reapproachment with Africa. But then you also conducted a lot of interviews with diplomats and in Mozambique as well. And they sort of give another image of this relationship, right? They don't seem to give the same importance to Brazil that Brazil perceive of itself.
Yeah, I mean, it also depends on their position in government. I would say that diplomats, I, for example, interviewed a diplomat who had been in Brazil, who had lived in Brazil. He had this great, expressed his great love for Brazil, you know. Basically, Brazil could do no wrong, and it was a very important partner in this and that. But when you start talking more with the technocrats, you know, the people, you know, who deal directly with the projects, then they say, you know, Brazil is one more partner. It's an important partner, but it's one more partner among many others as we try to diversify our connections. And so it was very interesting to hear this from them, because often, you know, we just get one side of the story. Often we only get the Brazilian side of the story, not nearly as much importance as is given to the Mozambican point of view in all this, because Mozambique is the quote unquote recipient. And then there's this like idea that it's common sense that Brazil is a certain kind of donor, an emerging and a cordial kind of donor. And it's so like its technical cooperation is so important in Africa, but it's technical cooperation. Actually, when you start looking at the numbers, when you start talking to people, it's a very, very small part of it. You know, even within Brazilian Development Cooperation, it's a very small part, at least, you know, financially. They say, oh, it's more about, you know, giving training and this and that, but still this aid cannot be compared to the aid of, you know, the United States, for example, or even China now. Like China has, you know, of the emerging powers, China is the one that's getting the closest to the OECD, of course, in terms of aid.
Maybe we should go to the different projects you study. You actually studied three projects in three different sectors: mining, health, and agriculture.
Yep.
Could you start with the mining project? Because being it an industry with deep colonial roots, how did the government in Mozambique justify this project, and what were the results?
Well, the mining project, actually, I went to the archives at Itamaraty, the foreign ministry in Brazil, and I asked for all the boxes about from relations with Mozambique, right? Mm-hmm. So I read like as many diplomatic cables as I could, and the mining project was the one that came up the most. It's one like the main, I would say, the main continuing thread in their relations since the 1970s. There was even, you know, it was still a colony. And in 1971, they were already talking about this. A Brazilian diplomat was already saying, we need to do this project because this project is what's going to guarantee, economic relations between Brazil and Mozambique. And all these countries are trying to come in here already, you know, and we have a lot of competition. And then this same discourse is repeated over time, you know, in like with a little bit of difference, but this is, you know, but it's a story of many Brazilian diplomats pushing for this project to be done. And in Mozambique, especially President Joaquim Chissano pushing this to be done as well. But it was not until the 2000s that Brazil agreed to do this project, that Vale do Rio Doce, now Vale, agreed to do this project. They kept going back and forth on whether to do this or not, because it was like a huge endeavor. Since colonial times, yeah, Portugal had been trying to develop the coal mining industry in Mozambique, but there are always logistical challenges and challenges in terms of conflicts as well. And these themes also kept repeating themselves over time, and you still have them. So it's very interesting to see these same threads running through, you know, many years and different regimes and things like that. And the way that Mozambique justified taking up this project was, we need to develop the country. You know, that's their discourse. We would do whatever it takes to develop this country. The Portuguese already had some blueprints, and we decided to expand on them, to expand on the infrastructure that we already had. And this pragmatic discourse was also a running thread when I spoke to Mozambican officials. Pascoal Mocumbi, who was one of the leaders of the independence movement, said to me that actually they didn't really care who they went with. so like at independence, they wanted to go with the ones who were giving them the best deal.
Of course.
In terms of aid. So I don't know how they actually felt at the time, but now, you know, he told me this, that we wanted to develop the country. So that justifies everything, you know, in this discourse. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, if you could compare it maybe with the other two projects and the different focus, the one where I think that the focus is trying to highlight the idea of making Mozambique a country less dependent on foreign aid, right? With one project trying to create a factory for Mozambique to produce and sell its own anti-HIV medicines, and the other one trying to modernize, whatever that means, the agriculture system in the country.
So they're all connected. Right? They're all connected. The first connection is that part of the money for the factory came from Vale, right? The company that heads the mining project at Moachizi. And
could you explain why they chose to also give the money for this project?
So they have a corporate social responsibility wing, and they have a lot of projects going on. And they have very, of course, close relations with Brazilian Development Agency and Brazilian, you know, different departments of the Brazilian government. So they were asked to step in when Mozambique was having trouble with protests and food prices and things like that, to give this money as a contribution. So in a sense, they became a development actor as well, Vale. And in terms of Pro Savana is part of the same development corridor as the Moachizi mines. So it's all connected, you know, in a sense of resources being shipped around. And there's very much this idea of spillover in the Mozambican discourse.
What is this term of this
spillover? Is when you have an industry, an extractive industry. So this would justify having an extractive industry in their discourse, because then other industries will pop up around it, right? To, you know, serve the rich people who are coming in relation to the mining project. Then you have tourism, you know, so this is an example of spillover. And actually this agriculture project, like, and the factory project, they all came together with this mining project, you know. So one thing brings in another. And then you have a whole, you know, small companies being developed to serve the needs of this mining project or the needs of ProSavana, the agricultural project, also in relation to the factory. So this is the idea. And the idea is also that extractive projects will, as you said, spill over into less dependency for the country, because then it'll develop more of its own industries because of that. And it's like, in a sense, contradiction, because it's a lot of it is dependent on foreign money. So you're using dependency to get out of dependency, you know, kind of a circular reasoning in a sense.
So in yeah. your view, does this kind of thinking work? Or should we shift the paradigm? Or is there a way of measuring the success of these projects and their goals?
It's difficult. It depends on what your definition of success is, you know? Right. Is your definition of success having an X number of industries? Is your definition of success being able to produce your own vegetables, you know? So in a sense, okay, you're producing vegetables, but you're still a commodity provider. You're producing coal, but you're still a commodity provider. So how do you get out of that role as a commodity provider? And if you get out of that role, maybe, you know, probably another country is going to be your commodity provider, you know? And this is like the whole notion of development. It's like you're getting up, someone else has to be down, you know, to do the jobs that you're not doing anymore. So is there a way to think beyond this, to have a more equitable system, you know, where the division of labor is more equitable?
Is there a way?
Million-dollar question, right? But I think, I mean, it's worth asking these questions. You know, there hasn't been a, you know, I guess a dominant theory that has really challenged what, you know, development is supposed to mean, what actually happiness is supposed to mean. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because we are so used to measuring happiness by possessions, and we think that this is, you know, what we should strive for. This is what makes an evolved human being, you know? So it would take a huge change in mentality, you know, because, you know, also people in Africa, they, you know, they want these things. You know, we have all been taught to want these things, to measure our worth based on possessions, on how we look, on the cars that we drive, you know. And I'm not sure that's really success or if it's a trap, you know. But I don't know anything else either, so. But I think about these things a lot, even like in my daily life, you know, especially with Corona.
We have time to think about
that. We have time to think about it, yeah.
And when they talk about human development, are they trying to move away from this mode of thinking, or is it part of the same paradigm?
It's part of the same, because human development is directly tied to productivity. They want to improve conditions for people so they will be more productive. And then they want to improve, you know, productive capacity so there will be more human development. So they're, you know, very much tied to each other. But like, if you read their development strategies, they talk about, you know, high rates of HIV making people unable to work. You know, so we should reduce the, you know, the HIV rates, because it's all part of this infrastructure, you know. And during colonial times, they also talked about human development, you know. So the discourse has been recycled even by international organizations, and it's all tied to greater productivity and industrialization, because you have to have healthy workers. So, I mean, I'm not saying that it's completely about that. I'm sure, you know, they care about people to a certain extent. But again, I mean, even like, I would say even in the United States, you know, there is this discourse of like maximum productivity, self-optimization. And I think human development in the U.S. is very much tied to that, too. You know, let's oil that machine well, you know, make sure that it lives and produces as long as possible, you know?
Yeah. Even pleasure is measured in terms of being productive. Would you utilize your time?
There are so many self-help books, you know, in the US about this.
And since we're coming to contemporary times, you've finished your book like a year ago, I guess, and you didn't have much time to include or to reflect on Bolsonaro's presidency in Brazil and how that might have changed or actually not their relations with Africa. Since you finished your book, have you seen anything different or anything that was surprising, or are things still the same?
I mentioned a little bit the Bolsonaro presidency and how mm-hmm. they were already interested in Africa. They don't claim to have, you know, close bonds with Africa, but they're definitely interested economically in, for example, Mozambique. Already early in his administration, he sent people to visit the factory, the medicine factory in Mozambique. And they, from what I understand, they want to turn this more into a commercial endeavor, also for Brazil, rather than like a social endeavor, which is very much in alignment with the Bolsonaro's neoliberal discourse.
Right.
So there is, I mean, the pragmatism is still there. I mean, if there's a good business deal in Africa, they won't shy away from that, you know?
You also said at one point that this pragmatism has also been harmful to Brazil's image, because they don't seem to be able to keep up to their promises, or they are not that reliable if they change according to their interest.
That's right. So in one sense, the pragmatism and the flexibility makes them less reliable. It also makes them promise more things that they can deliver on, you know. Mm-hmm. I think Lula made a lot of promises that they cannot deliver on. Because a lot of agreements are made by presidential handshake, and then the development agency could not deliver on it. And on the other hand, Brazil uses its pragmatism of flexibility and do like identity as an emerging power, like in between, you know, a developed and developing country, to tell these countries that, you know, they're more relatable. So when Brazil messes up, it's like, oh, it's because we're still a developing country like you. And I'm sure you understand.
Right. You
know? So it's like, it's really, you know, they use, it's very malleable, like the Lusotropicalism discourse is malleable to fit different occasions. So they can use it to talk to African countries. They can use it to talk to former colonial powers, you know, like they can use it on the right wing, the left wing, you know. It's... it very much mirrors, you know, the Brazilian mixed identity in world politics. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for this wonderful talk. I think we're taking quite a lot of your time now, but would you like to tell us a little bit of what you're working on right now, or what your next projects are?
So right now I'm applying for postdoc positions, and the project that I would like to do involves participatory budgeting in Mozambique. So this participatory budgeting initiative started actually in Porto Alegre in Brazil in the late 1980s. And then the World Bank took this and started implementing it in countries around the world, especially, you know, African countries. And actually it's... it involves regular citizens having a say on how cities spend their money. That's the simple version. Huh. Yeah. So I would like to spend some time in Mozambique to see how this these projects are working out on the ground, and how much localized they have been, and how much they how much they're using like the global participatory budgeting discourse, and how much of it is their own. I don't know if I'm making myself clear.
Yeah.
So how much like these lines, you know, are, you know, being put to practice, and how much they come up with their own approaches, and whether people are really allowed to participate in the decision making, or whether this is just on paper, you know. So I would like to know how it's operationalized on the ground there.
So is there another trip to Mozambique awaiting you?
I hope so. I hope, yeah, definitely at some point. I mean, not right now, for sure.
Of course.
First, also, I need to find a postdoc position. So if you hear of anything, let me know. But with this corona nightmare, maybe some of it can be done remotely, you know, but the ideal situation would be to be there and observe this in action, actually, on the ground.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Well, I hope, yeah, that you find a postdoc soon and that you can do this project so that we can talk about it next time.
That'll be wonderful.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.